ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He was the man who stole the plans for the atomic bomb. A brilliant physicist, a devoted communist. A spy hiding inside the most secret project on Earth. This is the story of Klaus Fuchs, a man who believed he could serve two masters, science and the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app.
On Sunday, April 13, at 3:30 in the afternoon, a man carrying a 30-centimetre knife walked into Sydney's Westfield shopping centre at Bondi Junction and started stabbing people. Six died, a further 12 were injured, and a police officer shot the man before attempting and failing to save his life. It wasn't a terrorist attack. Behind it lay mental illness. 40-year-old Joel Couchy was homeless and suffering from schizophrenia. The coroner heard he'd fallen through the cracks. In this special summer series of The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National, we're examining the kind of Australia we want and whether this is the kind of Australia we're prepared to accept. The economic and personal costs of mental illness are huge, but so too would be the costs of tackling it. Are we even prepared to try? Welcome to Choose Your Own Australia from The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and this examination of the kind of Australia we want. Joining us are Steve Robson, a health economist and surgeon who was until recently head of the Australian Medical Association, and Jenny Gordon, who used to head research at the Productivity Commission and is now with the Australian National University. Welcome, Steve. Welcome back, Jenny.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Lovely to be back.
Steve, you actually had something of a personal connection to Joel Couchy. What was it?
Yeah, Joel Couchy and I both hail from Toowoomba. I am a Toowoomba boy, went to Mount Lofty, and his family lived not too far from a number of friends of mine.
What do we know about him?
We know that Mr. Couchy had a story that will be familiar to many people around the country. He was an Australian who was diagnosed with a condition called schizophrenia as a young man. And initially his treatment was adequate, but over time the treatment he received, the resources that were available to him, let him down. He ceased treatment, he moved to Sydney, was not receiving psychiatric care in Sydney, and was living rough. And nobody really knows what happened in the final days. But it seems fairly clear that he became floridly psychotic. And for whatever reason, we'll never know, he launched the attack in Bondi.
What does schizophrenia do to people who have it?
Schizophrenia is what we call a psychotic condition. And a lot of people use schizophrenia as a shorthand for a split personality. But in fact, it means you are split from reality and that your thought processes bear no real relationship to the reality that we all live in. People frequently have hallucinations. They will see or hear things that are not there. They very commonly have delusions, typically that they are being persecuted or that there are forces that are malign and trying to harm them. People with schizophrenia live on average about 17 years less than other members of the community. It has a profound effect. It affects the way you live your life, the way you access services, even where you live. And commonly the medications that we use to treat schizophrenia cause all sorts of what we call metabolic side effects.
How common is it?
So if we look at the reasons that people have hospital contact around the country with a mental illness, schizophrenia dwarfs all the major conditions like bipolar disorder or depression. Schizophrenia uses enormous amount of hospital resources right around the country.
So it is a burden on everyone because of the costs of treatment. Also a burden, clearly, if you have many fewer years of life from someone who would be able to contribute to society, also a burden if they're not able to contribute to society properly. Jenny, economics is the language we use in bureaucracy, in the public service. It's the language we use to get things done. Does it surprise you that there's not more interest among economists in mental health?
Well, I think this is a hard nut to crack. And so economists sort of say, well, where's the low-hanging fruit? And that's the easy stuff where you can go, I've got a policy option where I know the benefits are going to outweigh the costs and I just have to convince politicians and the public that this is a good policy option. And once you get into mental health in particular, health can be hard and there can be hard choices to have to make. But once you get into mental health, you know, just the description there where the medication has problems, so the treatment has problems as well as the condition has problems. And so it comes down to one of the things that we're really not very good at arguing is minimising harm. And so, you know, that argument of harm minimisation as an approach when people say, no, you've got to cure people or you've got to stop them doing things that might contribute to their poor mental health, or you've got to kind of really take an alternative medical approach. And what we really need to do sometimes is say, well, what is the most cost-effective way? And that's really hard when we don't have the right set of information to be able to do this. And it's very individual specific as well. So I think it's just a really tough one. So the economic tools are there, but we don't really have, I guess, almost the data and sufficient understanding of the policy levers we can pull and what happens when we pull those levers for economists to kind of feel very confident about what they're talking about.
When the Productivity Commission did examine mental health in 2020, shortly after you left it, it found that almost one in five of us experience problems every year. Almost one in two of us experience problems over our lifetime. It found that the costs to the sufferers exceeded $150 billion per year, and the broader costs to everyone in lost productivity and lost workers exceeded another $50 billion per year. It recommended changes that would cost just $2.5 billion per year and produce benefits it said would be $20 billion per year. And yet, we've just had a productivity roundtable, and it was barely mentioned. It wasn't mentioned at all in the Treasurer's concluding statement. Why, Jenny, do you think it is not gaining traction?
It's not a lever we can pull easily and suddenly workers will become a whole bunch mentally healthier and a whole bunch more productive. So it's just not really part of the productivity agenda. It's more part of the long-term human capital accumulation. But how do we get good engagement? And I think one of the things that we have is we've got this concept of regrettable expenditure, which is expenditure we make that we wish we didn't have to make. So if there were fewer car accidents, there'd be fewer, you know, people needing to be treated for car accidents. And if everybody had better mental health, there'd be, you know, less cost associated with that. But we can't really match a treatment easily to bring down the cost of those regrettables, if you like. It comes back to that complexity problem. We stick it in the too hard basket.
What would you do, Steve, in terms of making treatment, I suppose, more accessible and easier to provide? And I think you're going to say one of the problems is that it's not easy to receive.
I think there are a lot of us who have transient, relatively minor mental health problems, and we know that they'll settle and they don't usually need treatment. There's some groups of people who will have more serious things, but ultimately they will respond and people will generally get better. And there is a group of people who will have intractable, severe mental health problems that impair them across their lives. And I think they're a group who, for them, a lot of the problems aren't actually medical. I think seeing a psychiatrist, receiving medication is actually the least of their worries in some respects. Having somewhere to live, having safety, not living rough and being a victim of crime yourself, being able to get to an appointment because you can't drive. having people just organise you, a lot of the things that make the life an outcome for a person with a severe mental health problem are nothing to do with doctors or psychologists. They're to do with being helped in the community to be safe and to be able to get to things and have an income and have your possessions safe and somebody to help you with your medications and things. And those are so hard to do. They are very, very difficult and the community doesn't do them well.
In this series, Choose Your Own Australia, we are putting problems into buckets. We have one program about the industrial transformation, about Australia, another about housing, this about mental health. And you're suggesting that the buckets are mixed, which I guess is what we need to consider if we're planning to choose your own Australia. That's the title of this special summer series of The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guest today, health economist Steve Robson and ANU economist Jenny Gordon. Stephen, treating mental illness is one thing. Tackling the causes is another. One of the places you just mentioned that it's worthwhile starting is housing, which might come as a surprise to people who think about mental health in one bucket, housing in another. What is it about housing and mental health?
So housing allows you to be safe. It allows you to organise your life. It allows you to just have life admin. It allows you to get adequate rest and protection. It protects you from infectious diseases. It gives you a place where you can have bills sent to or correspondence sent to. And all of these things are so fundamental that we don't think about them when we are mentally well.
At a talk you gave to economists that I was at, you said that 1/3 of homeless people have schizophrenia. 20% of people on public housing waiting lists have some sort of mental health problem. Is the link that strong?
The link is very, very strong. And if you walk around our cities and you go to certain parts, you will see people sleeping rough. And there are various circumstances around that. And, if you can't afford a home, if nobody's there to support you, if you're seen as a bad rental risk, you're likely to find it difficult to find somewhere to sleep that's safe. And if we look at surveys around Australia, about one person in three who is sleeping rough has a chronic severe mental health problem.
Jenny, lying behind this, and you sort of mentioned this earlier, and Steve, you mentioned it too, is ability to cope with systems, with bureaucracies. You've called it sludge, Jenny. I find it difficult to cope with systems. I find it difficult to fill in forms, and I can use a computer. Is this sort of a broader thing that essentially traps people with mental illness in that condition and makes it incredibly hard to get out of?
Well, I think sludge is there for everybody, and governments design sludge in sometimes to reduce the use of services.
Deliberately?
Deliberately.
You're thinking of things such as robo-debt.
Well, robo-debt was just a disaster of a program.
No, but robo-debt, we know this because of the Royal Commission that,
yes.
In fact, the forms that were sent out, the letters deliberately didn't have phone numbers on them to find out what was going on, which immediately made it very hard for someone who's not brilliant at firing off emails to respond. So we know in at least that instance, sludge is deliberate.
That's an interesting one, because that almost is just trying to make the scheme impenetrable and unanswerable.
The word evil came to mind reading the Royal Commission.
Well, reversing the onus of proof was clearly a major problem. But the other thing is that we have moved very much to an individualistic and a really market dominant system. And this idea that, private providers will have an incentive because of competition that they want clients.
This is in the NDIS, and you're in the Productivity Commission when they first came up with the notion.
Yes, I was. And in many ways, it's still a brilliant design, because it is giving agency to people who didn't have agency before. Before, you kind of went along and you might have hit the sludge of filling in all the forms. You certainly hit programs where they went, we've kind of run out of money because we gave a whole bunch to the first, you know, sort of 100,000 people who applied, and then we don't have any money to have anybody else enter the program. This is fundamentally changing the program. What it failed to do was really create a second layer of coordinated services between the states and the federal government. So a lot of the things that it had been there that people might have been able to access who have temporary needs rather than long-term needs, which NDIS is designed for long-term needs. And so we lost the services that really supported the people with temporary needs, which meant the people who had temporary things said, these are long-term. Once you're in the NDIS, you want to don't want to get out of it. And so particularly, you know, parents with children with developmental delays who are concerned about them, and early intervention we know is one of the things that can really, really pay off and help kids learn enough to be able to learn to read and write and participate in society and eventually get a job, you know, and those are really important things. But these are just hard to do. They're very hard to do.
More generally, in other areas, not only the NDIS, in superannuation, in childcare and so on, we've introduced a market system where there wasn't one, where there was government provision for all, whether it was done well or badly, it was done to a certain standard and you didn't need to make a choice. Do you have a view on that, Steve?
Look, I think we know that if one area of the economy is ripe for market failure, it's health. And that's why health is so regulated around the world in every aspect. And I think you run into what we call the doctor's dilemma, which is while we all agree we should be good stewards of the health budget, when you have an individual patient in front of you, they want everything thrown at it. And exactly as you said, with care for children with neurodevelopmental disorders, people want everything, and I understand that. But we also need to be good stewards of the health resources. They're limited, and we need to say, well, you know, what do we do? How do we balance things to get the best for all? And to be honest with you, I think one of the things that happens is people undervalue mental health problems, and because they're more difficult to see compared to physical problems, but they're so important. And I think we need as a society to recalibrate and say, well, how do we get this balance right? What's important? I don't have an answer, but I think we have to do it.
The Commission, Steve, found that the most important thing was early intervention. This isn't about dealing with people who've got mental health. It's about prevention. And that started actually when parents were expecting. It was in schools. And surprisingly to me, it was in tertiary education, the years when mental health problems become apparent for many people. Ought we to be making this a responsibility of teachers, the education system?
Look, I personally think we put a lot of demands on teachers as it is. And you know that we've just had a total revolution in the way that we live our lives. We're much less personally connected and more digitally connected. There are social media pressures on people. And the teenage years, the school years, are a time of particular vulnerability. So I think I certainly agree with Jenny that this is a time for early identification and early management. And if we can do that, we're likely to get the best bang for the buck in the long term.
One of the things that I also worked on the PC's childcare inquiry and talking to early childhood educators and the experts in the field, it's very, very clear that it's not your average kid who's got parents who read to them at night and who are engaged and take them out to play groups and things who need early childhood care. It's the kids who don't have access to that, who have parents who are stressed, who may actually have mental health problems, who are really struggling and they're unable to give that level of attention. But to come back to the teacher point, and I think that's you can't just keep layering on teachers more and more things to do. So I think we need to rethink that balance again and work out how we can support getting community more involved in these sorts of care services, these sorts of early identification. You know, how do we help people through the sludge of applying for a government service? It's the neighbour, it's the friend, it's the people in that community who, if they were there to help provide that service, we could probably do a lot better.
How do you feel about that, Steve, getting teachers to do more? I say that, I come from a family of teachers. They have a lot to do already. And so do police have a lot to do already. Right.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult idea, and I agree with Jenny that layering more and more responsibility on teachers is difficult. And I think in the end, police do have a strong involvement with mental health, but they don't have the tools to deal with a lot of people carefully. And they often the only solution is, you know, custody. And we see around the country, our prisons are full of people with mental health conditions, and it's really hard because they just don't have anything else. So I think as a society, we need to understand the critical importance of mental health problems, the fact that they are multifactorial, and say how important is this to us, and how do we apportion resources to get the best good?
If it's multifactorial, it comes from the entire environment. Might the mental illness we're seeing be connected with lots of changes we're seeing impacting us broadly, and not only Joel Cauchy, all of us are feeling that younger generations are being left behind in one of our other programs, a greater use of electronic devices, diet, all sorts of changes. Is there something in the soup that, or I suppose, what are the bits that you can see in the soup, Steve?
I think you're absolutely right. These things have a broad range of influences. There's evidence and everything from the microbiome in our gut having a very strong link to mental health conditions.
Mental health from our stomach to our brain.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because of the food we're eating.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a very different set of bacteria and other organisms growing in our gut, and we know there's a strong connection between gut function and brain activity. We know that digital connectivity means people are catching up less. They're seeing different images. They're being stimulated in different ways. There are so many things around the community that are different. And I think all of these are contributing to the increased prevalence of mental health conditions.
And Jenny, I guess this fits in with what you're saying about the intractable nature of supply and demand analysis, of cost-benefit analysis.
Yes, I think this just sort of points to the challenge. You're kind of saying, well, let's tackle this one and then let's tackle that one. And I like to think about these things as you've got to be really careful. You've not got a balloon that you're squeezing, and you squeeze one bit of the balloon in and it pops out somewhere else. And so I think we need, as policy, you know, people who are trying to do good economic policy or social policy, you've got to be looking at what the consequences are of the sort of unintended consequences. So what if I do this, is it actually leading to the things I thought it was going to lead to? But then is it leading to other things that are detrimental, and I need to be aware of that? And so it's that sort of monitoring to go, this is going wrong, let's stop it, is one of the things we could do better. And that would actually mean that at least you're not wasting money on programs that clearly don't work, and you'd want to spend a bit more time trying to focus on those that do. So evaluation is still important, and we're going to muddle through, you know, but it does take, the more we have these kinds of conversations with the Australian public, the more they realise there's not simple answers. They don't just have to, you know, I'm watching the Bell Gibson movie at the moment, and, you know, these people drinking juices was going to solve everything. That's a simple solution. It sounds good, particularly if you like juice. I think I might miss some more solid food. But, you know, that's our problem, is that people want something simple. They want to be able to grab something and say, I've got the answer for this. And often it's, occasionally you're really lucky, and that's true, but often it's really complicated, and you just got to chip away at it, and you've got to try and get your systems to work better together. And I think that's one of the things that we need government to really focus on. We need to focus on coordination.
Because this is Choose Your Own Australia, I want to ask a brutal question to each of you to close. Are we up for it? Are we prepared? First, are you prepared? Secondly, do you think that we are prepared for a nation with better health and the costs that will entail? Some of them is more tax, right? Steve?
I like to think of expenditure on health as an investment rather than a cost. And I think we fall into this paradigm of saying it's a a drag. I think it pays off in the long term, and we know there's evidence that preventive care saves the system in the long term, but it's going to mean some short-term pain. But I think particularly with mental health, most Australian families now have been touched in one way or another by mental health, and I get a strong sense at every level people think it's important, and I hope this is an opportunity to look at how we can make sure we allow the next generation of Australians to be as mentally healthy as we possibly can.
Jenny, do you think we're up for it?
Oh, I think we all want to be healthier.
Are we prepared to pay for it? And a lot of reorganisation society, removing sludge, for instance.
That, I think, is the really big question. And it comes from, we need leadership from the top. And it's what we've had previously is, you know, politicians say, you know, this I've found the answer, and here's the answer, go implement it to the public service. I think you've actually got to say to the public service, you have a responsibility to start coordinating this, to test solutions, to have the authority to pull back if you think they're not working. And so one of the things that we need public service to actually be given more permission to make decisions. And I think that's, you know, because honestly, they have far more expertise, and people will surprise you if you give them some agency. And I think you need to give public servants agency so that they don't go, I know if I go through my list and I tick the boxes, I can't get fired. Now, that's not helpful because that adds to sludge. And the more boxes you tick, the more it looks like you've done everything right, right? And so what you actually need is to go, what are my performance criteria? Have I talked to the people who are in the state programs who are dealing with the same kinds of people I'm dealing with? This is my list of people, and am I talking with them? Are they thinking about what I'm doing? So actually what we want to do is actually we want to reward cooperation. And so people learn that you don't get punished for talking to the state. It's not a competition of how can I cost shift out of the feds onto the states, or for the states to cost shift out of the states onto the feds. It's actually about how can we communicate together. And if you set the performance criteria for your public servants right and let them make, you know, accept that they will make mistakes. And the media needs to take a hand in this too, because the media clams down on any mistake and highlights it and says, oh, look at the terrible politicians or the terrible bureaucrats or, you know, the terrible government. This gets seized. And we actually need to change that narrative to sort of say, they're going to make mistakes. Have you never made a mistake? I've made plenty. But what we want is for them to be able to identify and correct those mistakes. And so the media, instead of saying, yeah, all your fault, you're terrible, look at this horrendous government program, says they identified a problem, they're fixing it. And wouldn't that be a better story?
So a change in attitude is something we could do if we were prepared to do that would not cost billions in its own right. And I should say, if you know anyone who needs help, anything you've thought about as a result of today's program, you can call Lifeline on 131114. Steve Robson, health economist and surgeon, who was until recently head of the Australian Medical Association, and Jenny Gordon, former head of research at the Productivity Commission, now with the Australian National University. Thank you both so much.
It's a pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
And thank you for listening. This is a special summer season of The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National entitled Choose Your Own Australia. You can find the other parts, the other choices right now on the ABC Listen app. They're about choosing to become a green industry superpower, choosing to put homes within reach of young people. Each of them choices we might want to make, but each of them a gamble with risks. Email us at theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.